Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is August 2nd, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 15. Normally, I record each issue of my monthly audio letter around mid-month or later, but this month, I must make an exception because of the urgency of what I have to tell you. In monthly audio letter number 12, 3 months ago, I revealed the joint Rockefeller-Soviet plan for nuclear war one to be waged primarily on American soil. In that tape, I also revealed the existence of the super-secret nuclear safe zone, a swath across the upper half of the continental United States and lower Canada between the latitudes of 40 and 50 degrees north, within which nuclear attack had been agreed not to take place under secret agreements between the four Rockefeller brothers and their Soviet allies. The fact that the four brothers themselves take this agreement very seriously is reflected by the fact that they have virtually abandoned the famous Rockefeller Estates at Pocatico Hills, New York, moving their secret documents and other assets to their other homes on Mount Desert Island and Bartlett Island, just off the coast of Maine, right in the middle of the nuclear safe zone. Only today, in fact, Nelson Rockefeller entertained reporters at Seal Harbor, which is on Mount Desert Island. But in monthly audio letter number 12, I also reported that more and more of the trustees of the major Rockefeller-controlled foundations, through whom the Rockefellers exercise their control over our economy and our government, are increasingly fearful that the one-world program of the Rockefellers has jumped the tracks. Over a period of 50 years and more, the wealth and power of the Western world, especially the United States, has been bled off in a continuous transfusion to strengthen the Soviet Union artificially. But now they see increasingly that they have opened Pandora's box and that a terrible double-cross by the Soviet Union is looming closer and closer as the hideous dead end of their behind-the-scenes control of our nation. The very next month, in monthly audio letter number 13, I was able to reveal the existence of a Soviet-planted nuclear weapon in the waters near the entrance to Seal Harbor, Maine, ready to destroy the summer homes of David and Nelson Rockefeller upon Soviet command. And just 2 weeks ago, in monthly audio letter number 14 for July 1976, I revealed the presence in American territorial waters not only of three more bombs, but of 10 short-range, underwater-launch, multiple warhead missiles with nuclear warheads. We are now in the grip of a grotesque rerun of the deadly Soviet missile crisis of 1971, which I revealed and described in monthly audio letter number 14. Now as then, our leaders are not telling you one word about it, but this time the Soviet threat is vastly greater and more imminent than it was in 1971. What the Soviet Union is hatching, my friends, is a devastating naval surprise attack of worldwide dimensions, which goes far beyond even the huge dimensions of the threat I revealed to you last month. No less than 25 countries around the world are now threatened with surprise attack by the Soviet Union at any moment the Soviets may choose by means of underwater-launched missiles and bombs planted by the Soviet Navy. It has now been 2 weeks since I recorded monthly audio letter number 14, in which I challenged the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff to take appropriate action about the deadly Soviet nuclear offensive weapons in our territorial waters, and in which I pledge my readiness to cooperate fully with the Joint Chiefs. My challenge and offer of cooperation were also transmitted directly to the appropriate officials. But my friends, as of this moment, I have not received one word of official reply to my charges, my challenge, or my offer to help. the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have been given notice of specific aggressive acts by the Soviet Union that imperil the peace and security of the United States, the placement of offensive nuclear weapons at strategic locations within American territorial waters. But to my knowledge, up to this moment, they have not taken any action whatever to seek out, much less to destroy, any of the bombs or missiles I revealed last month, including even the missile near Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, whose location I spelled out in navigational coordinates. So long as this inaction continues, they are failing to protect our shipping, to protect our vital sea lanes of communication, to maintain general naval supremacy in our own waters, and to protect crucial naval bases and property, among other things. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are in flagrant and continuing violation of Title 10 of the United States Code and of the Department of Defense Directive 5100.1, which spells out the functions and responsibilities of the armed forces of the United States. What is the meaning of this? Does this mean that the Joint Chiefs are so completely trapped and insulated by Rockefeller agent Henry Kissinger that they are no longer free to do their duty? My friends, what hope can there be for us when our most trusted and respected leaders, civilian and military, fail us through treason and fear? The answer is that ours is not the only government facing this terrible Soviet threat. So I have turned this information over to them, too. And while the United States government sits paralyzed through fear and Rockefeller treason, other governments are taking action. Meanwhile, my own efforts are to rob the Soviets of the crucial element of surprise which they are counting on to make their worldwide naval attack successful. Today, I want to discuss these three topics. Topic number one, the Rockefeller sellout of America to the Soviet Union. Topic number two, the Soviet strategy for surprise naval attack in Nuclear War I. And topic number three, the worldwide locations of Soviet underwater missiles and bombs. Topic number one. In the early fall of 1938, an international conference was held to consider Adolf Hitler's demand that the Sudetenland, with its heavy German population, be ceded to Germany by Czechoslovakia. For years, the Third Reich had been rearming itself to the teeth in open defiance of the Treaty of Versailles. But the Western Allies, afraid of offending Hitler, had done nothing about it. Prior to Czechoslovakia, Austria had been annexed under the pretext of racial ties like those in the Sudetenland that demanded such an organic relationship to Germany. The Allies had done nothing about Austria, and now Britain and France agreed as well to Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland. On September 30, 1938, the fate of the Sudeten residents of Czechoslovakia was decided without their own participation when the infamous Munich Agreement was signed. Amid widespread relief, peace in our time was proclaimed. But less than a year later, on September 1, 1939, World War II began with Hitler's invasion of Poland. Just over a year ago, on July 30, 1975, a new Munich Agreement was signed. 35 signatories were involved as the Helsinki Accord was signed, sealing the fate of the Soviet satellites of Eastern Europe as a stable relationship referred to as organic and permanent by high officials of the United States Department of State. Widespread praise for the so-called spirit of Helsinki assured us all that détente was doing fine and all was well. Meanwhile, the steadily accelerating Soviet military buildup has redoubled its pace in clear violation of the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties, SALT, which forbid such major new weapons as the huge Soviet SS-19 ICBM now being deployed. In the past 10 years, the military superiority once enjoyed by the United States has been systematically and deliberately eroded, always with the excuse that our failure to unilaterally disarm in stages might seem provocative to Russia. Meanwhile, the Soviet buildup has doubled and redoubled to the point where nations around the world are expressing increasing alarm at such military preparations, which now go far beyond anything that could conceivably be limited to self-defense. The situation is becoming so ominous that more and more nations, which have formerly kept their silence rather than to risk offending the Soviet Union, are now crying out in alarm. In May 1976, in the same month in which I recorded monthly audio letter number 12, telling you of the mounting fears of a Soviet double cross by certain trustees of the major Rockefeller-controlled foundations, the clamor of concern over Soviet military intentions began building up. For example, on May 9, 1976, Denmark's foreign minister, K.B. Anderson, was quoted as saying about neighboring Soviet and Warsaw Pact exercises, quote, "The military activity in the last few years has been more than is necessary for defensive purposes. It is more than is reasonable in the spirit of Helsinki," unquote. The Danes are especially worried about amphibious landing maneuvers which are being carried out on the Baltic coast and which are moving ever closer to Denmark, which controls the straits which lead from the Baltic into the North Sea. A week later, on May 16, 1976, Denmark's growing concern was echoed by West Germany's foreign minister, Herr Gesner, who said that the Soviet Union has armed itself beyond its defense needs, creating a danger for European security. About the same time, half a world away, the Japanese were increasingly voicing serious concern over Soviet military escalation. Since the beginning of 1976, there has been a dramatic increase in Soviet naval and air activity in the vicinity of Japan, including frequent scrambling of aircraft, numerous violations of Japanese airspace by Soviet aircraft, and submarine exercises just off Japan. By late May, the same thing had been taken up by Great Britain. On May 26, 1976, British Foreign Secretary Crosland told the Central Treaty Organization foreign ministers, quote, "We cannot ignore the evidence of our eyes. It has been precisely during the years when the Soviet Union has advocated détente that we have witnessed the steady buildup of the Soviet armed forces," unquote. Nor have the warnings by leaders of other countries abated. Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser has rightly criticized détente as an illusion used by the Soviet Union to veil its imperialist designs. Red China, which is badly weakened at the moment by the devastating earthquakes, has expressed worry over the recent strengthening of Russian land and air forces along her northern frontier. And only 3 days ago, on the first anniversary of the Helsinki Agreement, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, leader of the Conservative Party in Britain, reinforced her warnings voiced earlier this year concerning the very real and growing threat posed by the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, here in our own United States, all attempts to voice similar warnings are suppressed, muted, and diffused. Recently, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General George S. Brown, revealed that while the American Pacific Fleet should be able to keep sea lanes open to Hawaii and thereabouts, quote, "because of a shortage of warships, the fleet will not be able to protect the sea lanes into the Western Pacific," unquote. Admiral James L. Holloway, chief of the naval operations, has gone even farther, declaring that American warships now operate in the Sea of Japan only at the tolerance of the Soviet Pacific Fleet. No wonder the Japanese are worried. But perhaps the most dismal estimate of the situation comes from retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, who flatly says that the United States could not win a war against the Soviet Union today. Well, he ought to know. It was while he himself was Chief of Naval Operations that the Soviet missile crisis of 1971 occurred, involving underwater missiles in American and Canadian waters, as I revealed last month. Meanwhile, Rockefeller Soviet agent Henry Kissinger speaks comforting lies for American public consumption about the military inferiority of the Soviet Union. And our interim president, Ford, speaking words put in his mouth like a ventriloquist by Nelson Rockefeller and Kissinger, solemnly lies to us that there have been no violations of the SALT agreements by the Soviets, and that they have refrained from using any loopholes in the SALT agreements. The Rockefeller major media drum lies like these into our heads, creating a false sense of security. We, the people of the United States, as well as of the other countries now under the threat of the Soviet surprise attack, have been sold out by the four Rockefeller brothers and their agents in and out of government. Our trust of those in positions of leadership has been used against us at the very highest levels. We have all been double-crossed for the private gain of a handful of greedy, callous men. And yet, even they, too, are about to lose everything in the same way, double-crossed by the Soviet Union. Topic number two. In this age of intercontinental ballistic missiles, Viking spacecraft landing on Mars, and B-1 bombers, it is easy to forget the indispensable roles played by land and sea forces. The vast tonnages of commodities that travel around the world in international trade travel not by air in most cases, but by land and especially by sea. For reasons of simple economics, the sea is still the unrivaled highway of the world's commerce, spelling prosperity for many and survival for some. And as long as this is true, navies will always play a major role in a nation's military power. If some Americans have forgotten this, the Soviet Union has not. For over two decades, just one man has been continuously in command of the Soviet Navy, Admiral Sergei Gorshkov. The Soviet Union has less need of a navy for defensive purposes than many other nations, but for 21 years, Admiral Gorshkov has worked relentlessly to build the Russian fleet into a formidable striking force worldwide, and he has succeeded. Starting as a minor defensive military arm when Stalin died in 1953, the Soviet Navy has been built into a modern armada in astonishingly short time, and it is still expanding rapidly. While the United States has been shutting down shipyards at home and losing bases abroad, the Soviet Union has been building new shipyards and stretching its reach by opening more and more bases far from its own shores. Even now, before the new American naval base is built on Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the Russians are angling for a new base in the South Pacific on the island of Tonga, north of Australia. Gorshkov has said, quote, "Establishing the conditions for gaining sea control has always required prolonged periods of time and the execution of a series of measures while still at peace," unquote. He also emphasizes the importance of the Soviet fleet for exercising, quote, "influence on coastal countries," unquote. Gorshkov claims that his navy is now capable of fighting anywhere as a political tool in furthering the Kremlin's aims, including not only the wartime role of severing sea lanes, but even possible peacetime harassment and interference with shipping. He now considers the Soviet Navy to be, quote, "a long-ranged armed force which could exert decisive influence on the course of an armed struggle in theaters of military operation of vast extent," unquote. In other words, The Soviet Navy is now a global striking force, and Gorshkov recently signaled his fleet that it will be the Navy which will bear the brunt of any armed conflict to come. Western military analysts have been puzzled by recent indications that the Soviet General Staff is preparing, quote, new methods of repelling aggression and waging war, unquote. Well, anti-tank guided missiles, which many analysts are concentrating on, are just a sideshow in these so-called new methods. The real focus in current Soviet military planning is the Navy. And prominent among these new methods are the underwater launch missiles and bombs, which the Soviet Navy has now planted in coastal waters all around the world. Topic number 3. In monthly audio letter number 14, which I recorded just 2 weeks ago on July 19, 1976, I reported the presence of 4 bombs and 10 short-range underwater launch missiles with multiple nuclear warheads in the territorial waters of the United States, all of them planted there by the Soviet Union. I can now confirm that all of these bombs and nuclear warheads are of the thermonuclear variety, that is, hydrogen bombs, as opposed to smaller atomic bombs. What is more, the list for North America now includes 2 more missiles, one at the south end of Chesapeake Bay near Norfolk, Virginia, and the other in Canadian waters near Vancouver, Canada. Of these 2, the Norfolk missile has been planted just within the past few weeks. Here now are the navigational coordinates for the locations of the 16 nuclear weapons in United States and Canadian territorial waters. Most all of the locations are firm, but some could be off 1 or 2 miles. Near the entrance to Seal Harbor, Maine, hydrogen bomb, latitude 44 degrees 17 minutes 0 seconds north, longitude 68 degrees 14 minutes 0 seconds west. In a cove off Boston Bay, near Quincy in Weymouth, Massachusetts, missile, latitude 42 degrees, 14 minutes, 30 seconds north, longitude 70 degrees, 59 minutes, 0 seconds west. Long Island Sound near Bridgeport, Connecticut, missile, latitude 41 degrees, 9 minutes, 40 seconds north, longitude 73 degrees, 5 minutes, 0 seconds west. Chesapeake Bay near Deal, Maryland, east of Washington, D.C., missile, latitude 38 degrees, 46 minutes, 0 seconds north, longitude 76 degrees, 33 minutes, 0 seconds west. Potomac River near Indian Head, Maryland, south of Washington, D.C., hydrogen bomb, latitude 38 degrees, 33 minutes, 40 seconds north, longitude 77 degrees, 12 minutes, 0 seconds west. South end of Chesapeake Bay, near Norfolk, Virginia, missile, latitude 36 degrees, 58 minutes, 30 seconds north, longitude 76 degrees, 16 minutes, 0 seconds west. Inside Pensacola Bay, Florida, missile, latitude 30 degrees, 23 minutes, 30 seconds north, longitude 87 degrees, 11 minutes, 30 seconds west. In the Mississippi River, near New Orleans, hydrogen bomb. A correction here from monthly audio letter number 14. The bomb is downriver, near Port Sulphur, Louisiana, rather than upriver. Latitude 29 degrees, 35 minutes, 30 seconds north. Longitude 89 degrees, 50 minutes, 30 seconds west. In Galveston Bay, Texas, missile, latitude 29 degrees, 22 minutes, 10 seconds north. Longitude 94 degrees, 49 minutes, 10 seconds west. Inside San Diego Bay, near Chula Vista, California, missile, Latitude, 32 degrees, 38 minutes, 0 seconds north. Longitude, 117 degrees, 7 minutes, 0 seconds west. Inside San Pablo Bay near San Francisco, California. Missile, latitude, 37 degrees, 59 minutes, 0 seconds north. Longitude, 122 degrees, 23 minutes, 0 seconds west. In American waters between Northwest Washington State and Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Missile, latitude 48 degrees, 13 minutes, 0 seconds north. Longitude, 123 degrees, 8 minutes, 0 seconds west. In Canadian waters, southwest of Crescent Beach, near Vancouver, British Columbia. Missile, latitude 48 degrees, 58 minutes, 9 seconds north. Estimated longitude, 122 degrees, 57 minutes west. In Prince William Sound, Alaska, near the entrance to the Port of Valdez, hydrogen bomb. Latitude 60 degrees, 57 minutes, 40 seconds north. Longitude 146 degrees, 44 minutes, 15 seconds west. In the waters just north of Cologne-Panama Canal Zone, missile. Latitude 9 degrees, 25 minutes, 30 seconds north. Longitude 79 degrees, 54 minutes, 45 seconds west. And finally, in the coastal waters just outside Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, missile. Latitude 21 degrees, 18 minutes, 30 seconds north. Longitude 157 degrees, 58 minutes, 58 seconds west. My friends, get out a map and mark these locations on it. See for yourself just how complete the surprise attack is that is being readied for the United States Navy. Then, after you have absorbed that, listen on, because, my friends, there is more, much more.